first the state budget crisis, now public schools in Illinois could lose their funding if the state government can't agree on how to fund them.
I'm not afraid of the governor. I don't think we're afraid of the speaker. What I am afraid of is telling the 2,000 students that they can't come to school.
We learn what's at stake with WUIS's Dusty Rhodes and school superintendent Wes Olson. Plus, we go back into Illinois history and revisit our conversation about how the Haymarket affair changed not just the city of Chicago, but the entire labor movement.
The idea that an eight-hour day is just a kind of given thing and that we've accepted that, that's not true. People had to really sort of, struggle and persist in order to achieve even that.
And the Girls Rock Camp in Champaign is trying to include more women in rock and roll.
And I kind of wanted to take this opportunity to be that woman behind a drum kit in front of young girls and be like, look, this is a thing you can do.
That's Christine Palin. She's a drum instructor at the camp. All coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. Now, it's funding for public schools that's at stake in the political fight between Governor Rauner and the democratically controlled General Assembly. The budget deal that was finally reached earlier this month won't include money for schools unless the state adopts what's called an evidence-based funding model. That already exists in the form of what's called Senate Bill 1. It passed both the House and Senate with bipartisan support, but hasn't been sent to the governor's desk yet, in part because he's promised to veto parts of it that include funding for Chicago schools. This morning, the governor held a news conference and gave Democrats an ultimatum. Send the bill to his desk by noon on Monday, or he will call another special session. We'll talk with the school superintendent in just a moment. But first, joining us from Springfield to help us understand SB 1 and all that this is about is Dusty Rhodes. She's the education reporter at partner station WUIS. Dusty, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks.
So you always have the unenviable job, I guess, of explaining the formulas and everything that goes into funding education here in Illinois. But, we could spend the next hour just trying to explain all this. But briefly, can you just remind us what Senate Bill 1 would do?
So this evidence-based model really is sort of the icing on the cake of funding. What it also does is bake in the existing funding that's made up of the current formula, so that no district loses money. It's a hold harmless. That's very crucial to getting legislation through. The only district that would lose is under the Republican plan. Chicago Public Schools would lose quite substantially. They get about $250 million more than their vouchers would, show that they deserve. And the Democratic plan, Senate Bill 1, would allow them to keep that in their hold harmless. The Republican plan would allow them to keep about $50 million of that, but take the other $200 million and redistribute it to all the other districts. That's one part of it. The other part, and the part that Rauner obviously is very focused on, as you heard in that clip, is teacher pensions. Right. Now, Chicago is the only district that pays its own teacher pensions. You and I pay the teacher pensions for the other 850 districts. We don't get any say in how those pensions are negotiated, and they vary widely from district to district, from as little as $300 per student that we're, that taxpayers are footing to $1,400. So there's a huge disparity there. But both pension funds, both Chicago and the teacher retirement system, which applies to the rest of the state, have a big unfunded liability. Under Senate Bill 1, Chicago would be given like a tax credit for that. They're not given the money, but it's factored in as part of what they need as their cost of doing business. Mm-hmm. And Rauner doesn't like that. He calls that a bailout. The Republicans call that a Chicago bailout. The thing about the evidence-based model is that it takes a look at the demographics of each district and says, okay, this is what you need to educate these kids. And then it takes a look at your property assets, your property taxes, and says, this is your available resources to educate these kids. Do simple math. Here's the difference. That's what the state is going to fill in. But again, that's just the icing on the cake that's over the base funding minimum. The thing about this new formula is that it rejiggers every year. It recalibrates based on what you need and what you get. So it's built to like fill up the tier ones first. The tier ones are the poorest districts. And the more they get up to adequacy, the less they will get. So everything will change again every year. So for people to look at that and think that that's what we'll get every year, that's not true.
There's a general agreement that there is disparity in the way that the current model funds schools throughout the state. So this bill, it sounds like, if I'm understanding what you're saying, would protect kind of the existing structure, but new money that comes in would be redistributed in a way that would be seen as more equitable. But again, not touching that core, the core center that you said was baked in.
Except for Chicago.
And then therein lies the fundamental disagreement then between, the Democrats and Governor Rauner and some of what he's saying right now.
Right.
I would like to bring in, someone else in the conversation here. Wes Olson, superintendent of Bond Community Unit, School District Number 2 in Greenville, about 45 minutes east of St. Louis. Superintendent Olson, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me today.
Oh, of course. I appreciate you talking to us. I mean, the last two-plus year budget standoff here, K-12 education was one of the things that lawmakers made sure to fund, at least basic operating money. Now there's a budget, but the threat of no funding for schools, just as you're about to open your doors next month, what would happen to your students if the state doesn't come up to an agreement on school funding?
Yeah, there's definitely a little irony there, isn't there?
More than a little, yeah.
As far as the budget's concerned. For us, we are a smaller rural district. We have, nearly 2,000 students spread out through several communities. And about half of our revenue comes from the state. So for us, the impasse for the past 2 years was detrimental to education as well.
And so you're already weakened isn't the right word, but you've already taken a financial hit.
Absolutely. And on top of that, if you look at the years of proration where the general state aid that we were receiving was prorated, 89%, 90%, so on and so forth. I mean, our district, if you calculate it up since 2011, has been shorted $5 million from the state. So what that means from an operational perspective is that you spend down any reserves that you have over that time, and I think that's the case for many districts like us, particularly downstate, that don't have the opportunity to access a large amount of property wealth, and first of all, weren't sitting on a lot of cash reserves when the proration started and the impasse started, and now we're at this point where FY18 there is no budget. That it really truly is a crisis mode.
Yeah, so what are some? I mean, that sounds like there's some tough decisions then. I mean, what sort of choices would you have to face? What sort of would you have to look at cutting things? So is it possible that at some point your doors couldn't open?
Yes, I mean, we've been cutting things for years. I mean, just to give you an example, we've reduced our transportation services to the effect that we have students, oftentimes kindergarten students, on the bus for over an hour. We've eliminated all of our counseling and social services that are provided to students and families. We've delayed essential repairs in our buildings. We talk about oftentimes about Maslow's hierarchy of needs and looking at that when figuring out how we're going to spend money and where it's going to go. And oftentimes when the roofs leak, when there's not heating, when there's not cooling, obviously that's a situation where it makes it difficult for students to learn. We've eliminated a number of extracurricular budgets that local folks have stepped up and taken care of. We have textbooks that are 10 plus years old.
So it sounds like any more cuts would really be, I mean, getting into the, you sort of look at that hierarchy of needs, you're getting into the important stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the next step for us is the elimination of any curricular offerings that aren't essential. So, or what wouldn't be considered core offerings. So music, art, all those types of things. And as far as FY18 is concerned, over the years as that burden of funding our schools has transitioned to our local, You know, we have folks around here who are bearing the burden of it with their local property taxes as well. And we continue to borrow, and we continue to do those things that usually are kind of break in case of emergency techniques you have for finances that, quite frankly, we've just had to operate that way for the last 7 years.
So we've heard a little bit about, you know, from Dusty Rose about SB1 and what that would do and kind of shift some of the funding, a little bit new funding anyway, around the state. How would SB1 affect your district?
For us, it would be an increase, and we certainly would welcome that. You know, we fall into one of those areas that we are certainly not a tier one. We aren't the neediest district, but also we have we would fall in the tier two. And you know, any consistency in funding for us is considered a win. And Senate Bill 1 provides that. I mean, you know, like I said, we're in crisis mode down here, and so you take the politics out of it, and we're about kids. And we're about serving the communities that we have. And without an appropriation bill, without an evidence-based model that's going to get us the money that was appropriated in Senate Bill 6 and Senate Bill 9, you know, we are definitely in a place where whether or not we can start or finish the year is in question.
Is in question right now. And you said, you know, take the politics out of it, but right now that's almost impossible. I mean, you're caught in the middle of a political standoff right now. You know, the governor recently said that school superintendents who support SB1, like you, have been intimidated by House Speaker Michael Madigan and Democrats. I mean, do you feel like you've been intimidated into supporting this funding plan?
Here's my response to that. You know, as a superintendent, again, and this isn't a political statement, I'm not afraid of the governor. I don't think we're afraid of the speaker. What I am afraid of is telling the 2,000 students and families that we have here that they can't come to school. So if we want to talk in fear or use that term, yeah, there is. It's not fear of the politics. It's fear of not being able to serve the communities that it's our duty to do.
And we're talking right now about the funding model here on the 21st and the provision in the latest spending bill that would hold up funding for public schools, K-12 education, without what's known as a evidence-based funding model. That could be SB1, which is why that was put in there in the first place with the Democrats, by the Democrats, and now Governor Rauner is threatening to veto portions of the bill. We'll kind of see where that where all that goes. Dusty, just to come back to you here for a couple of minutes, what can people expect here in the next few weeks coming out of Springfield? Where is this debate right now, and what do we expect in the next couple of days?
Well, one thing that we can expect is more stories like Superintendent Olson. I hear those all the time. His isn't even the saddest one. I've heard so many school districts talking about cuts that they've made. That's pretty brutal. So, you know, I've checked with all my sources and they don't really know when, you know, the Democrats are holding on to this bill. They haven't sent it to the governor yet because they know he's going to veto it. And they're trying to figure out how, you know, can they override his veto or can they push him up to the limit? It's kind of a game of chicken.
And Superintendent, coming
it's
back,
scary.
And yeah, I mean, that's sort of Superintendent coming back to you. I mean, what, and I can kind of hear it in your voice as you're talking there. And you mentioned sort of fear and some of the driving factors here and some things you're concerned about. But what is the mood like among teachers, parents, students, you know, as you're coming up on the school year there in your district?
Interestingly enough, I think that there is still a misconception that that we have a budget because Senate Bill 6, Senate Bill 9 were passed, and I hear that often. I hear, hey, you know, aren't you happy we got a budget? Well, not exactly. So basically, we're in the process of kind of breaking that news to our parents. It's interesting. That information is going out parallel with information about registration. And registering your children for the school year, but at the same time we're talking about how it's likely it's a possibility that with funding in jeopardy that we might not go to school for a whole year. So it's really a tough thing to share that news again with the families that we serve and not be a little frustrated with the politics that are behind it. I mean, at the end of the day, I think a lot of us, and again, downstate superintendents as well as superintendents throughout the state, are tired of politics over people, and ultimately we're here to serve, and we're here to serve kids and families, and it makes it tough to do when the politics are such as they are.
And that's the voice of Wes Olson, Superintendent Bond Community Unit School District Number 2 in Greenville. It's about 45 minutes east of St. Louis. Also heard from Dusty Rhodes, education reporter, WUIS, based there in Springfield. Thank you both. I appreciate you explaining sort of how this is working and what's coming next.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Coming up next on the 21st, we revisit our conversation about a labor strike that changed the course of history. Nyla Boodoo talks with Paul Jurica and Robert Lorzel about how the Haymarket Affair changed labor and politics in Chicago. Stay with us.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. 131 years ago, Chicago workers went on strike for an 8-hour workday and to protest the deaths of several workers at the hands of police. And when officers moved in to break up a protest, someone threw a bomb. At least 4 civilians were killed, along with 7 police officers, dozens wounded as well. This became known as the Haymarket Affair, and it forever changed not just the labor movement, but the city of Chicago and world history. Paul Jurica joins us now. He's a Chicago historian, although his day job is the director of programs at Illinois Humanities. Robert Lorzel is also on the line. He's a Chicago author and freelance journalist. They're going to give us a sense back into what this was like, as well as present parallels for today. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having us.
Paul, there's so much to get into here, right? This is a huge, the Haymarket Affair, the Haymarket Incident is such a huge story, and there's so many different pieces of this. But I just wanted to start with, if you could put in context, how important is this in terms of labor history as well as the city of Chicago and Illinois history?
In order to kind of really understand its significance, you have to kind of place it back within the 19th century and kind of understand what was going on in the United States. In the decades after the Civil War, there's a whole series of depressions and recessions that makes life very precarious, particularly for working people and for immigrants. And kind of coupled with these kind of economic downturns are kind of moments of civil unrest in which the police and sometimes even the United States military are kind of called into urban centers to restore order. And oftentimes it results in violence, with the police directing their fire towards striking workers. So even though today we're going to be talking about a single incident that occurred at the intersection of Randolph and Splaines in Chicago on the 4th of May, 1886, I mean, its ramifications are great.
And when we think about that, as we think about this event, I wonder if you can describe a little bit more about the political climate at the time, as well as, you said, workers. I think we have a sense of what, you know, there are things that perhaps we take for granted today, like mm-hmm. an 8-hour workday and things like this. What was it like in the 1880s?
A lot of things that we take as givens today didn't exist health care provided by an employer, a pension system, child labor laws, minimum wage, even things like the weekend and the eight-hour workday. Now, Chicago, at the time of the Haymarket bombing in 1886, was like a lot of urban centers. It was rapidly changing to being a city populated primarily by immigrants. And in the late 19th century, the largest ethnic bloc in the city of Chicago were Germans. And you see that reflected in the Haymarket story. A lot of the men who spoke at the rally on the 4th of May were from Germany. But also, you see it in the sort of handbill that was used to kind of draw people to the event. So on the 3rd of May, 20,000 handbills were printed, basically calling people to a rally at Haymarket Square. And half of that handbill is in German, and the lower half is in English.
That's Paul DiRica. Robert Lurzel is with us as well. Robert did a story for WBEZ Chicago's Curious City about all of this. We'll tweet out that link because it's a really fascinating conversation with lots of people about the context of that. If you're interested in it, our handle is 21st Show. Robert, how were German immigrants viewed in Chicago, in the city, in American culture at the time?
It almost feels like it was a half German city with a lot of people of Irish and English heritage there as well. Among the Germans, you had some people who were pretty radical and in favor of things like anarchism and socialism. But you had plenty of Germans who weren't, you know, on that part of the political spectrum, just everyday people working of various political beliefs. So when you had something like Haymarket happening, you had the radical elements who were becoming sort of the scapegoats for what was going on. And this raised all kinds of criticisms of immigration. There were calls for crackdowns on immigration, where you can see some parallels with what's happening today.
Yeah. Before we get to that, Paul, can you tell us about, Robert mentioned different political groups. Anarchists are going to play a big role in this conversation, right? Because that's who eventually ends up on trial for everything. Before we get to what actually happened, who throws this bomb, what organizations, what political groups at the time were striking? Who were the sort of the players involved with all of this?
Well, there was a real spectrum involved. So the call to kind of make a push for the eight-hour workday was actually made by what became the American Federation of Labor, which today we think of as being a kind of mainstream labor organization. And they sort of set May 1st, 1886 as kind of the day to sort of make a push for the eight-hour workday all the way back in 1884. And so when the 1st of May, 1886 arrives, somewhere between 300,000 to half a million American workers all across the United States, men, women, and children, go on strike to push for the eight-hour workday. In Chicago, there's close to 80,000 by some estimates, some put it a little bit lower, who go on strike. One of the individuals who spoke at the rally on the 4th of May is a gentleman by the name of Albert Parsons. He was born in the United States, came from a very old family. He could trace his family back to the Mayflower, had great-grandfathers who'd fought in the Revolutionary War. During the Civil War, he fought on the side of the Confederacy, but then after the war had a political conversion and became a radical Republican, trying to fight to sort of preserve the rights of the recently emancipated slaves. But then he moves to Chicago with his wife, a former slave, Lucy Gonzalez, in the early 1870s, and he stops being a Republican and he becomes a socialist, which is left of center, but a well-established party at that time, and he runs for different city offices. But as a result of these kind of economic recessions and depressions that I described and the sort of like response by the police to some of this civil unrest, he becomes even more radicalized. So that by the time of the bombing in Haymarket Square, he's an avowed anarchist and a member of a kind of working man's party. So within the sort of space of, you know, about 20 years from the end of the Civil War to the bombing in Haymarket Square, you have one individual who's gone from being involved in a fairly mainstream major political party to being very, very far to the left and kind of calling for the complete sort of eradication of the state as we know it. And I think Parsons gives you a good sense of how kind of volatile political opinions and how varying they could be at that time. At the time, there's already other strikes that were happening for a variety of reasons. And down at the McCormick Reaper Works, you know, Cyrus McCormick invented the mechanical reaper that was based in Chicago. Well, his son had kind of locked out some of the more skilled workers and replaced them with what would be called sort of scab labor, right? Sort of like replacement labor. And so the former workers were outside the McCormick Reaper plant, basically kind of protesting that. And across the street, there were a bunch of lumberyard workers who were going on strike for the hour workday. and they were being addressed by a gentleman named August Spies. August Spies was a German immigrant. He came to the United States, and he started a kind of workers' newspaper. And so he was there basically kind of encouraging the lumbermen to sort of hang together and push for the eight-hour day. Well, the end of the workday comes, the whistle at the McCormick plant sounds, and the sort of scab workers begin to leave the factory, where they get into a tussle with the sort of striking workers. Police are called in, the police fire into the crowd of the McCormick workers, and it's believed at that time that about six workers died, although most historians now think that maybe it was at most two. Spies witnesses all of this, and he's horrified. So he decides to go back to his newspaper office, and since he runs a newspaper, it makes it very easy for him to print up flyers. And so after consulting with some of his associates, many of whom are really kind of radical people, right, socialists but also anarchists, he decides to basically kind of hold a protest meeting on the 4th of May in Haymarket Square. He prints out 20,000 of these handbills that get all across the city. And at that time, right, this whole thing is just being thrown together. So he doesn't even know who's going to speak at it. He knows he's going to be one of the speakers, but he expects to talk last and address the crowd in German. So he shows up there on the evening of the 4th of May. There's anywhere between 2,000 to 3,000 people who have gathered. And he's horrified to learn that his friends haven't actually found any speakers. So the meeting's starting a little bit late. Nobody's there to kind of hold the crowd together. So he decides first to kind of shift the location a little bit from Randolph Street onto Des Plaines, an area that's a little bit more protected. And he basically sends his friends off to find other speakers. So Spies ends up talking to the audience actually in English for about 30 minutes. And in that time, his friends are able to find two other speakers, Albert Parsons and another gentleman by the name of Samuel Fielden, who was an English immigrant and also a former Methodist minister and preacher who was there to kind of address the crowd. So Spies talks for about 30 minutes. Parsons, who's a very gifted orator, gets up on the wagon and addresses the crowd for about 90 minutes straight, just off the cuff. And then Fielden gets on the wagon last. By now, it's almost 10:30 at night. The day is overcast. It looks like it's going to rain any minute. And the crowd has dwindled to about 300. Now, mixed into the crowd in Haymarket Square is the mayor of Chicago himself, a guy by the name of Carter Harrison. Harrison's observing everything. It seems like it's going to be a peaceful rally to kind of protest what had happened at the McCormick Reaper Works. And so he goes that block south to the police station, where there's between 170 and 180 police officers ready to march up into Haymarket Square and break up the rally, should that be required. The mayor says, "You can send all the boys home to the commanding officer because it looks like the meeting is breaking up on its own." The mayor starts to head back to his house, but before he can even get there, he hears a loud bang. And what has happened? Well, the moment the mayor leaves Haymarket Square, the commanding officers, William Ward and John Bonfield, order their officers to march into Haymarket Square. They confront Fielden, who's on the wagon right then, telling him to disperse the group. Fielden says it's a peaceful rally. And at that moment, somebody steps out from the crowd. And to this day, historians don't know exactly who that individual was. And that person throws a bomb into the center of the police's ranks. One officer dies instantly. Ultimately, eight officers will die as a result of the wounds that they sustain. All of the officers had handguns on them, so the moment the bomb goes off, they also start firing as well. The whole incident lasts about 15 minutes, but as I said, about eight officers lose their lives. It's unknown how many of the strikers were wounded or who die as a result of their wounds. And then ultimately, eight men are brought to trial in connection with the bombing.
Yeah. So, Robert, I wonder if you can step in here and say, so they never figured out who threw the bomb, but who are these eight people who end up on trial?
They were basically the speakers and other associates who were connected with the anarchist movement. But the big controversy here was these men on trial were not even accused of throwing the bomb.
Some of them weren't even there, right?
Some of them had been there at various points during the evening, but some of them weren't even there or hadn't been there at all during the night. So the idea was that they were all part of this conspiracy. You know, they either had plotted to have this bomb thrown and have this attack on the police, or that their speeches had provoked this kind of action. It's kind of the prosecution is sort of making an equivalent argument of, you know, this was not protected speech of what they're doing because they were provoking people into acts of subversion and violence. But they were being charged with murder, so it was a very controversial, this idea of prosecuting them for this.
What does happen with these men, Paul? Would you say that the trial, from a historical context, the trial and the aftermath almost end up overshadowing what actually happened?
I would say so, but we also have to keep in mind what actually happened. So here we are about 20-some years removed from the Civil War and all of the sort of violence and devastation that attended that. But what happened on that night in Chicago was unprecedented, because you had a single person who could hold a single small device in his hand, throw it into the crowd, and kind of wreak this kind of havoc. And so people were scared, right? And when they got scared, they closed ranks and they went after anybody that they could attach blame to. And that's how those 8 men ended up on trial. And public opinion was very much against them in the beginning. But as the trial went on and concluded, and all but one of the 8 were sentenced to die, one of them, who had very little to do with the incident, was sent off to prison, but to a life term, I want to add. But in the aftermath, public opinion begins to shift slightly, so that by the time that the men have exhausted their appeal and the execution date is set for the 11th of November, 1887, there are many people who realize that maybe there's been a rush to judgment and that maybe there were some problems with the trial. What ends up happening is some of the men are encouraged to write to the then governor of Illinois asking for clemency, and 2 of them do, and they receive life sentences in prison. Another decides that he doesn't want the state to take his life, so on the eve of the execution, he commits suicide in his cell. He was the youngest person put on trial, so he was 24 when he went on trial and 25 when he took his own life. And then the following day, the 4 other men are put to death. And so after the execution, the bodies are returned to the families, and there's a huge funeral in what is today sort of Wicker Park neighborhood of Chicago that thousands attend before the bodies of the 5 dead men are taken to a cemetery outside Chicago. And that becomes a kind of rallying point for labor, right? And the memory of these men become a kind of rallying point for labor. And that's why starting in 1889, but really, you know, crystallizing in 1904, that's how the 1st of May becomes a kind of like labor holiday the world round.
This is fascinating. I'm speaking with Paul DeRica, a Chicago historian, and Robert Lorzel, a Chicago journalist, about the Haymarket affair. Guys, we just have a couple minutes left, and I have to talk about today, right? Because I feel like you can't have this conversation without looking at it in present-day context. And I wonder, Paul, how you think what the Haymarket affair tells us about what sort of what the parallels are today, what the lasting impacts of it are, and the way that we view labor, the way that we view... Why don't you do labor, and then, Robert, you can talk about sort of the way that we view immigrants as well. Paul?
To me, the biggest lesson about Haymarket is this idea that, like, nothing is a given, right? Today, a lot of us work more than 40 hours a week. But the idea that an 8-hour day is just a kind of given thing and that we've accepted that, that's not true. People had to really sort of, you know, struggle and persist in order to achieve even that. And that means that it can be taken away. And then, you know, the last several years, right, we've seen a really sort of concentrated attack on organized labor in particular. I would just say kind of working people in general. And a lot of these things that we've kind of regarded as given have been sort of taken away or eroded. That said, the Haymarket story can also serve as an inspiration, because these people were able to achieve a lot of things, right? And eventually we did get an 8-hour work day, and we did get child labor laws, and we did get pension plans and all the other things that I talked about a little bit earlier in this segment.
Yeah, Robert, what do you think in terms of, especially about immigrants? That's something I know you wanted to weigh in on.
It's striking how in the days right after Haymarket, people, including some congressmen from Chicago, raised concerns about radical immigrants coming to the country. And they began calling for a way of testing anyone who enters the country to see if they support the Constitution, the American way of life, and our government. And eventually, it didn't happen right away after Haymarket. It took a couple of decades leading up to the assassination of President McKinley. So finally, in I think it was 1903, a law was passed to keep anarchists out of the country. And I see parallels with what the Trump administration is talking about doing today, with trying to have some sort of way of blocking people who are radical Islamists from entering the U.S. But it all comes down to this challenging, difficult question of how would you even test someone to really see what's in their heart and then in their mind to see if they, you know, support the American way of life. How do you define that? So back in the 1800s, after Haymarket, there was efforts at it, but, you know, they never really came up with a system of doing that.
The sort of central questions around the story, whether it's the meaning of the bombing or the reaction to immigrant communities, or whether or not people can be held accountable not for what they do per se, but what they say in certain incidents. These are all issues that are very resonant in the contemporary moment.
Yeah, so it's sort of 131 years ago, and we're still having some of these same conversations. I want to thank Paul DeRica, public historian, director of programs at Illinois Humanities, Chicago-based writer, journalist Robert Lurzel, has a great story he did about this for WBEZ. We'll tweet that link out if anyone wants to go further into this history. Paul, Robert, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Society's just a long road of copy and paste, and we're all subject to its call. Pressure's on us all. No one would know, no one would know just how far we've come. No one would know.
That's Pastel Death Threat. They're one of the young rock bands that got its start at Girls Rock Camp. There's more than 40 such camps across the world. The latest is starting later this summer in Champaign-Urbana. In our Urbana studios right now is Amy Guerin. She's a board member with Girls Rock Camp CU. Along with her is Christine Palin. She's a volunteer and drum instructor at Girls Rock Camp CU. On the line with us from Chicago is Kate Walsh. She's with Girls Rock Camp Alliance. Christine, Kate, Amy, welcome to the 21st, ladies. Thanks for being with me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Amy, can you tell us a little bit about what Girls Rock Camp is?
Sure. Girls Rock Camp is a camp for women and girls, because we're also going to have a ladies rock, to learn about music, to maybe touch an instrument for the first time or learn how to play. Anything from drums, guitar, bass, keys, to learn how to write a song, produce it, and then perform it in front of a live audience. But along with that are the important aspects of feminist culture and punk culture. We're teaching them that the values of DIY, of the empowerment, of being able to get up in front of someone and perform as a female in an industry that is dominated primarily by cis men, that they have value as well as the skills and capabilities to do that as well.
And so Ladies Rock Camp, Kate Walsh, I wonder if you could explain, does that just mean older people, not just, is that kids? Or what does Ladies Rock Camp mean, Kate?
Yeah, so Ladies Rock Camp is often a fundraiser that camps use for their youth camps. And basically adults go through everything that a camper would go through over a weekend, so just in 3 days. So they learn an instrument, they form a band, and then they write an original song and perform it at a local venue. So it's a way for us to build community with adults and as well as our volunteers and folks who are just interested in camp, and raise money at the same time for our young people's camp.
Kate, how did the Girls Rock Camp Alliance get started?
So the Girls Rock Camp Alliance started in 2007, and it was a group of six different camps from the U.S. and then from Sweden and from London as well. So we found that there were all these new camps starting, and we really wanted to start working together more, sharing resources, and building a community of Girls Rock Camps around the world.
Amy, I wonder if you could tell us how Girls Rock Camp CU got started. What was the idea behind wanting to start one in Champaign-Urbana this summer?
Sure. I think that it was noted by the very strong music community that we have here, that we enjoy here, that there weren't a lot of all-female bands or even bands with any female presence. And we wanted a way to open that door and to encourage all women, all girls, to be able to creatively express themselves in that manner. And so we've had a ton of support from the community, especially the music community in Champaign-Urbana of coming together, you know, making plans, fundraising, organizing, volunteering, in order to make this opportunity available to the girls in our community.
Christine, how did you win and why did you get involved?
Well, I had been familiar with the Girls Rock Camp Alliance for a while. I'd always been interested in the work they do, and I've always been inspired by that. And then last summer, Isaac Arms, who's one of the organizers, posted about how we were trying to get something like that started in Champaign. And I, as someone who came, I was always really interested in rock music, but I came to making music really late compared to a lot of people I know. I didn't start learning the drums until I was 18, about to turn 19. And a part of that reason was because I didn't know any women who played the drums.
I was going to say, Christine, do a lot of people say to you, oh, you're a female drummer?
Because
I feel like you probably get that a lot, right?
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of times it's from other women saying, you know, like, oh, it's so cool to see a woman playing the drums. And sometimes it can be men being gross and or condescending. But yeah, I mean, I'm one of the only non-cis men who plays the drums in Champaign. And I didn't really have that presence in my life. And I kind of wanted to take this opportunity to be that woman behind a drum kit in front of young girls and be like, look, this is a thing you can do. So I just heard about it through Isaac and asked to be involved when the time came. And now we're getting things going and I'm very excited.
Yeah, Christine, did you want to play music your whole life?
Yeah, so I grew up loving music and I started playing piano when I was 5 and I kept up with that until I was like 14. And I always liked piano. I had a wonderful teacher, but I was never super passionate about it, and it just wasn't the instrument for me. And I grew up loving rock music. I grew up on, my parents loved classic rock and also some contemporary stuff. Like, my first concert was Avril Lavigne when I was 5, and I stayed loving music. And in high school, I really got into Paramore. That was like my first really big love for music, and I was always like, oh, I wish I could be up there like them. But I I convinced myself I didn't have the talent for it. I convinced myself, oh, it's not for me. And then it all changed when I started college here at, I started going to U of I, because my freshman year I started writing about music as a journalist and started going to shows and interacting with music and interacting with musicians who were real people. And it became a tangible thing. And around that time I started getting into bands like Bikini Kill, Slater Kinney and Slater Kinney was the band that made me want to learn the drums, because like, Janet Weiss is an amazing drummer, and she didn't start learning the drums until she was in her 20s, and she was self-taught. And hearing that story, like, wow, I can do this at any point in my life. There's no narrative I need to ascribe to. And that really changed things for me. And so I always wanted to make music, but was too scared to do it. And then when I was 18, I just decided, all right, I'll learn the drums. And here we are. And I'm very glad I made that choice.
Kate, as we're hearing Christine tell her story, I wonder how important you think it is in terms of, do you think, is the point of this also really to give young women role models at these camps? Because, I mean, as we talk about that, I think when we're thinking about sort of like female representation in music, that's like kind of a whole other conversation we could have as well. But I wonder if we could just start with the role models for these camps.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that we have only women and trans folks and gender nonconforming folks in roles, in leadership roles at Rock Camp. And I think that's a really powerful thing. Like y'all were kind of mentioning before, that it's really, if you haven't seen a lot of women in those roles, it's really exciting to see that. And also to see different gender presentations of folks at camp, I think is really transformative for a lot of our youth. I also think it's developing those relationships and developing connections between adults in the music industry and also young people, and having that kind of continuous connection. So yeah, I think that's a really important tenet of Rock Camp and something that we really look for, look to build even more than it is right now. So,
When you say that, Kate, we heard a little bit of a song at the top of this segment from Pastel Death Threat. They were a band that formed last summer in Chicago.
Yes.
Do you know how many new bands have been formed as a result of young women attending the camp?
Oh man, I think in Chicago we have 20 bands per session, so 40 bands a summer, and we are actually we are growing a ton. So We probably have over like 3,000 bands that have been formed, and even more form each summer. And we almost have we have about 100 camps now worldwide. So we're growing and growing. So it builds even more each summer.
And how do local camps get started and work with you guys nationally?
I think it really depends. I think with Champaign-Urbana, Isaac Armstead, the idea, reached out to us. Lots of times people will volunteer at other camps that are outside of where they live, and they will be like, oh, I really want to bring this back to where I live, where my community is. Or people just like see something online or see something in the news and are like, we need this here in our city. So each camp starts individually and is independent of like an independent member of the GRCA. So we're not like a franchise or anything like that. So each camp starts independently and is really, that's one thing I love about Rock Camp, is that each Rock Camp is so different and really tries to like fit the needs of their local community. So that's, and then they usually come to us for advice, for resources, for networking, for curriculum, things like that.
That's Kate Walsh. She's with Girls Rock Camp Alliance. We're talking about these camps that happen all over the world, and there's one about to start this summer in the Champaign-Urbana area. In our Urbana studios, Christine Palin and Amy Guerin are with us. Christine, Amy, I wanted to ask you guys about the whole notion. Christine, it sounds for you, it's great that your first concert was Avril Lavigne when you were five, but I wonder what you guys think about female representation, especially in rock music. Do you feel like that's something that's getting better, especially as we're looking at how much easier it is for people to sort of the institutionalization, I think, of music has broken down a lot, right? So if you can come up with sort of like YouTube or other ways to break into the industry, it's a little bit easier. Do you think that's made it easier for women, especially when we're thinking about rock?
I think so, yes. I think that when you look at, like, I just saw today, like, NPR, like, the users voted, like, best new artists of the year so far. And, like, it was, like, over half were women, like, the majority, and they were, like, last year as well. It was similar. And when you look at indie music, particularly indie rock, you're seeing a lot of these voices. I'm just thinking of albums that have come out this year. J-Sum, Pale Hound, recent years, Speedy Ortiz, you have Vagabond, you have, St. Vincent is a very prominent woman who plays amazing guitar. And you're seeing these voices in indie rock. And I think that's partially or greatly due to these alternate ways of accessing music and creating music. You know, you don't need to be on the top 40 to be recognized. Radio is less than radio in terms of the charts. Are less and less important, because people can just go on YouTube and look up your band or go on Bandcamp. I think the way we create and access music is helping that. It's helping people who might not otherwise have that access to it. I don't know if that makes sense, but I do think that the way these models, the music industry is changing and the way we access it is changing. And I think that's helping certain voices be elevated and carve out a space for themselves. So I think in indie rock, we're certainly seeing, I mean, all of my favorite records from the past few years have like pretty much all been like rock bands with predominantly women and queer folks in them. So I certainly, from my perspective, think that's changing. But I can't speak for the industry as a whole. Obviously, that's a whole can of worms.
Yeah. Kate, getting back to the Girls Rock Camp, what happens in the actual camp? Because it's not just music, right? There's social workshops to help women in other ways. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So, I think every camp is different in what kinds of things they do that are non-musical. But I know at Chicago, we have different workshop tracks that our youth can take. So that includes things like making a music video or electronic music, or we do things like screen printing and self-defense, and we have workshops around gender. We have a lot of different things that we do every day. So it's, I think it's kind of twofold. There's that kind of like media critique, that kind of thing. There's the kind of more thinking about the world workshops, and there's also these really hands-on workshops where they're learning other skills besides music. So they're also learning, you know, how to screen print, how to use GarageBand, how to make a music video, that kind of stuff.
Amy Christine, what's the plan for the CU camp? Are you guys going to be doing similar things?
Yes, actually, we will. We'll, of course, have the musical tracks as well as songwriting and performing, but we also plan to have sessions regarding social justice, empowerment, and perhaps something like zine making, in addition to learning how to record or to even run gear.
And how do people, when is the camp, if people want to get involved, how do they do that?
They can go to our website, which is girlsrockcu.org, or our Facebook page, and we will have information on the upcoming workshops and camp, as well as events for fundraising, volunteer opportunities available as well on the website and on Facebook.
And for people who want to attend the camp, you'll have that information as well?
That's correct. We will have registration open and available for the first workshop, which will be July 22nd, followed by another one August 5th.
Well, great. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about this. That's Amy Guerin. She's a board member of Girls Rock Camp Champaign-Urbana. Christine Palin, who's going to be teaching drums at the camp. And Kate Walsh on the line from Chicago with Girls Rock Camp Alliance. Ladies, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
That does it for us today. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.